You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. O'Connell, McNamara, we're on the radio. How are you?
Oh, very well. Thank you very much.
I was telling, I was lamenting, I was, well, I was lamenting the fact of the state of the United States Navy now, and how painful this morning is for all of us in a sister service. I would imagine painful for you, given your affiliation with the Naval Academy. And but I was reading an abstract from a paper that was done at the command the United States Marine Corps Command and Staff College by a lieutenant commander by the name of Mark A. Draghi, or Drag, D-R-A-G-E, lieutenant commander of the United States Navy. And this is the abstract. And I know they've changed it since, but it gives everybody some idea of what the Navy's gone through. Since 1970, Surface Warfare Officer School in Newport, Rhode Island, provided introductory education to newly commissioned division officers in the United States Navy. In January 2003, the Surface Warfare Officer School Division Officer course was streamlined and transitioned to a computer-based training curriculum. This thesis examines the effects that new division officers face with no formal classroom education, simulator, familiarization training. Sent directly from commissioning source to operational fleet, surface warfare division officers and traditionally taught surface warfare officers are now facing numerous leadership challenges. The U.S. Navy leadership are witnessing some downfalls due to the elimination of classroom instruction, are now re-implementing classroom instruction courses in fleet concentration areas. And my point was to contrast that with, you know, in the Marine Corps, you're on active duty between OCS, the basic school, and your MOS school for probably close to a year before you get to stand in front of anybody. And what a stark contrast the Navy, the Marine Corps is to every other branch of the service. And what a sad day it is when we have to think about 17 sailors are dead and nobody sounded general quarters or a collision alarm prior to the impact so that they could get out of their racks and at least have a fighting chance, that they were either killed in their racks or pinned in their racks and drowned after the hull got breached. And so pretty sober morning to say good morning and have you on. So first of all, good morning on that note.
Good morning, yeah.
But I'd be curious, your thoughts. You've watched this. It's a painful, painful morning for the Department of the Navy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's important to remember that military accidents, while not common, are part of military life and dangerous business that the armed forces undertakes. And just preparing for combat operations leads to training death. It's sad, but it's probably necessary for maintaining a ready and professional force.
Right. Talk about your relationship with the United States Naval Academy. Did you attend the Naval Academy?
I did not. No, the Naval Academy has about half of its faculty are military members and about half are civilian professors with PhDs. And even though I'm a Marine reservist, my job there was as a civilian. I was a civilian professor of history for about 8 years there. And it's actually quite a good system to have both military and civilian faculty teaching at our service academies, I think. It brings an important context that is lost if you have an all-military faculty or an all-civilian faculty.
Got it. All right. I wanted to have you on this morning, Aaron, because of the writing you've done and the work you've done and your experience in and around Afghanistan. Aaron is the editor of Our Longest War, Losing Hearts and Minds in Afghanistan. In the heels or on the backside of the president's speech, I'm curious about your thoughts. Are we pointed in generally the right direction relative to a national policy to Afghanistan?
Yeah, I listened to the speech very carefully, and I think I found some three things that were reassuring and three things that were disheartening, or things that gave me concerns. But generally speaking, to begin, I think the speech was characteristically Trump. It had some bold flourishes, some risky decisions, and in some cases more bluster than detail. And in a sense, I guess it had almost all the good and bad that comes with having a political outsider and a true military novice. In the White House. So the good, the three good things I heard, first is that we've finally moved away from the lunatic proposals we were hearing about a week ago when Mr. Bannon wanted to bring in Eric Prince of Blackwater fame and have Blackwater-like mercenaries take over the military tasks in Afghanistan. That was a proposal that was totally unworkable, possibly illegal, and definitely immoral. So I'm glad we're moving away from that. The second thing is that the president's speech sent some pretty clear messages to the Taliban and to the Afghan government that we're not taking an immediate withdrawal from Afghanistan. And that's good, I think. There is a good case to be made for withdrawal, and President Trump's earlier pronouncement as a private citizen that we should just quit and come home made that case badly, right? That was a case that lacked an appreciation for the risks of an immediate withdrawal. So not trusting his gut and moving away from just quitting is probably good. Furthermore, by making his message by not refusing to sort of set down timelines or to specify troop numbers, that gives him some flexibility. That strategic ambiguity will give him more options than President Obama had after he announced in advance that his 2010 surge would last only for 1 year. So that's good too. And finally, I think there was some creative diplomacy in the speech. The outreach to India, the warnings to Pakistan. The president gave us the outline of a regional strategy that leans closer to India and possibly away from Pakistan. So I think that's good too. There's been a lot of calls for a regional approach, and he at least gave us the silhouette of what that regional approach might look like. So those are all positives, and he deserves credit for those three things. The downsides of the speech are first that we really don't have enough information to actually evaluate the strategy or its cost in lives and treasure. So I know that there's a lot of benefits that people say, oh, it's good that he didn't telegraph numbers. But let's be specific. If he's asking for 5,000 more troops, that's the cost of $3 to $4 billion a year, I think he'll have no trouble getting that through Congress. If he's planning to return to 2011 levels of 100,000 troops in country at a cost of $100 billion a year, there's just not a snowball chance in hell that Congress is going to do that. That's an impossible, unworkable starting point to rerun an experiment that already failed of an enormous cost. So it's probably good that he's not signaling to our enemies exactly what we're going to do, but it was too thin on details to know if he's proposing something reasonable or frankly insane. And that's just the first bad thing. I mean, that's the first thing that gave me concern. He didn't tell us what winning looked like. He did not specify real end states that the military can use to make changes to its campaign plan. I mean, he said he was saying that. He said from now on victory will have a clear definition. But then he said that goal, that victory, is just killing terrorists. And that's just plain wrong. Every amateur military strategist knows that violence is a means to an end in foreign affairs. We use force to change the behavior of our adversaries. Right? The goal of the Gulf War wasn't to destroy the Iraqi army. It was to force the Iraqi government to stop occupying Kuwait. The same is true in any other war. We didn't fight World War II to destroy the German and Japanese militaries. We fought them to change the behaviors of government. So what's the desired end state in Afghanistan? And what are we willing to pay in lives and treasure to get there? He didn't answer either of those questions in the speech. And I guess finally, I've been talking for quite a while, finally, the entire speech focused almost exclusively on using military force to bring stability to Afghanistan. And I just have to say that I think that's misguided and unlikely to work. Since at least 2008, our own senior military leadership has been saying that we cannot kill our way out of this insurgency, and that the war will only end in a negotiated settlement. And it's important to remember this. Military operations are the most costly and usually the most destabilizing tools of foreign policy we possess. And if we don't pair them with diplomatic efforts or condition them to political progress on the ground and governance and corruption, the Taliban will continue to gain ground. So there was a consensus in the Obama administration, military and civilian leaders alike agree that we can't just use military metrics of numbers of insurgents killed or airstrikes to measure the path to an enduring peace in Afghanistan. And it seems to me that the president abandoned that belief in his Monday night speech.
What about he teased of the role, possibly a role, you know, can't see it right now, but possibly a role. And that, to me, that's what different people alluded to when analyzing his speech. But he did allude to the Taliban and the possible option of them being involved in a political solution to in Afghanistan. Your thoughts on that? Was it, again, was it not enough detail? Because, I mean, he threw that card out, and I would agree with you. Certainly not long on details, but I don't know if that's what that speech is meant to do. So talk to me about him alluding to the Taliban and possibly in one day they'd be involved in a political solution.
Right. He did say it. He had a line where he said, "We don't know when or if the Taliban will ever come to the peace table. And until that happens, we need to present a strong front. We need to escalate our operation, go on the attack." Now, the logic of that makes some sense. You negotiate with a strong hand, not a weak hand. The Taliban thinks it's winning. It's not going to negotiate until it thinks it's losing. Fair enough. But here's the thing. Even when we had 100,000 troops in the country, the Taliban thought it was winning.
Right.
So, if he is saying that we don't know if the Taliban will ever come to the peace table, but we're just going to continue to escalate until they do, I'm here to tell you that won't work. Every time we use the military, even when we use it well, even when we don't miss our targets or have errors or end up killing civilians unnecessarily, even when we do everything right, the mere presence of American military operations causes civilian death. Because the Taliban attacks civilians near our troops so that they can say if the foreigners would just leave, then there would be peace. So there is a real contradiction in using military force to try to stabilize the government. The more you do it, the more you run the risk of losing the population and them being just subject to too much violence. Every year we've surged in Afghanistan, civilian casualties have gone up. So I need to hear from the president, it did not need to be in that speech, but the senior military leadership of our nation, the people planning the campaign in Afghanistan, need to know exactly to what end they are undertaking these counterterrorism strikes. The idea that we will just kill all of the Taliban is nonsense. They have everything they need to fight indefinitely, and they can bring in new recruits and regenerate quite easily.
Okay, I want to talk about a couple of different things and transition away from his speech and talk about reality in Afghanistan. My guest this morning is Dr. Aaron O'Connell. He's associate professor of history at the University of Texas. He's a writer. He has incredible experience. Are you no longer on active duty or retired, Aaron?
That's correct. I'm not on active duty.
Okay, not retired though.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Currently a colonel in the United States Marine Corps Reserve. Talk to us about what does victory look like? And let's just say there is a political solution ultimately. How does us launching down this path walk me down the path where this course of action that the president's kind of pointed us towards, what has to happen for it to be successful?
Okay. Yeah, and let's move, you're right to move away from the speech because some of the moments in that speech were meant for domestic audiences,
right.
Some were meant as a message to the Taliban. Let's talk what really is going to change and not change in our approach to Afghanistan.
Right.
First, the president spent a lot of time talking about how we are not doing nation building, but we are. That was a disingenuous statement because ever since the Obama administration, we've been saying we won't do nation building. But what we are doing is institution building, and the institutions we are building are the institutions of state. The Army, the Police, the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Justice, and the Office of the Presidency and the Governor. We are still doing that, and you can't not do that. So we will continue to train the Army and Police and to put advisors in the ministries in an effort to create a successful and responsible Afghan security force that can fight the Taliban on its own.
Right.
So we will continue to do that. We will at the same time continue our counterterrorism operations against ISIS and against Al-Qaeda and against the quite numerous groups of foreign terrorist organizations that are in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. But the basic strategy to an end, to get to the end of this war and to get to a negotiated peace, that it looks like will remain exactly what it was in the Obama administration, which is to give the Afghan government sufficient resources and training to fight the war on its own, and then to continue to pressure the Taliban until it realizes that negotiation is better than continuing to fight. That has been the strategy since 2009.
Okay.
That's not changing. What is changing is that the president gave pretty clear indications and used some forceful tools. He made a nationwide address in which he called out Pakistan publicly, and he extended a hand to India. A bold move, a risky and creative moment of diplomacy that I must give him credit for, which basically signaled to Pakistan, we've partnered in the past. We've been partners on counterterrorism. We've been partners on a number of things all through the Cold War. If you continue to harbor and help the networks that are killing Americans, not only is that relationship over, but we will lean to your archenemy. The reason that Pakistan supports the Taliban is it fears Indian encirclement. And President Trump said on Monday night, if you continue down the unhelpful path you're on, we'll make your worst dreams come true. That's new.
All right, can you just footnote, can you explain to people, when you talk about Indian encirclement, explain to people that aren't familiar with that region what you're talking about?
Absolutely. Yeah. Pakistan is a young country. It's 70 years old. And when it broke off from India, it had actually two land masses, present-day Bangladesh, with East Pakistan, and then what we know of Pakistan today was West Pakistan. They lost that. They lost more than 50% of their population when Bangladesh went free. They are terrified of being divided up and carved up. So India is their archenemy. Both are nuclear powers. That's immediately to Pakistan's east, but Afghanistan is immediately to Pakistan's west. And the more that Afghanistan leans towards India, the more it becomes pro-Indian, as President Karzai was during the Karzai years in Afghanistan, the more that Pakistan fears, oh my God, we could have Indian or pro-Indian forces on both sides, and then we can't survive as a country. So that's the fear of encirclement. They worry that a pro-Indian Afghan government will be a strategic sort of impossibility for them, and therefore all their support to the Taliban is really just a form of messaging to the Afghan government and to the United States that we, the Pakistanis, will determine the political outcomes in Afghanistan, and if you think you can cut us out, you're going to find violence as the result. So by President Trump saying, Pakistan, we want to work with you. We realize you have interests in Afghanistan, but you are right now supporting the terrorists that kill Americans. That is intolerable. If you don't change, then we will, in fact, lean towards India. And that's why he's very specific. The speech, he said, we welcome more help from India, particularly economic assistance. He said that because he knows that if he had said, India, will you bring military advisors in to train the Afghan forces, that would probably be a bridge too far with Pakistan and could really precipitate a collapse. So it was a risky move. It's what you expect from President Trump. It's risky, bold, and creative, and it may cause Pakistan to change its behavior, particularly if we can follow it up with actually competent, well-resourced diplomacy.
Okay, now I want you to footnote that. Competent, well-resourced diplomacy, because, you know, we've gone down this path, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, where, you know, we're pretty good at the military piece. You know, we can go kill, we can go do what we're supposed to do. But I think one of the great shocks in 2004 that I experienced personally, when I actually had the good fortune of being, I didn't go there in this capacity, but General Mattis's aide got wounded. General Kelly, who I'd worked for at the Infantry Officer Corps, came to me and said, I want you to be General Mattis's staff sec. And I said, I don't even know what that is. And he said, and it doesn't sound very masculine, he said, it's not, but you're going to work with me. It's a much better job than you have here in division plans. So let's go. And I said, yes, sir. I said, who do I work for? And he said, Joe Dunford. I said, who's that? And he looked at me and he said, you're stupid, Mac. Just come with me. So, but one of the, in sitting in meetings, you know, when you're sitting at in those kind of meetings, to find out that there was no help on the way. There were no radios for police coming. There were no vehicles for the police coming. That we had toppled the government and hadn't really looked beyond toppling the government, in terms of what you just said, resources. And when our guy came back and said, this is what they have six radios, three of them work. They have seven cars, right, of which three of them work. And here's a handwritten roster in pencil of who's on the payroll. And we would expect that a third of these names are not actually real, and that money goes back to the leadership, blah, 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 blah. And you just sat there in the meeting and went, Are you kidding me? And so explain to everybody, in order to leave this well, right, stable economically, stable security, what does well-resourced look like in terms of non-military support?
Right. I think the non-military support is the key element here. So one of the major conclusions of our latest longest war was that the military had all the resources it needed. It did not lack dollars or tanks or planes or people to do what it was asking to do. And in fact, as you are sort of hinting at with your remarks, a fair number of those resources ended up being diverted because of a lack of auditors and just basic poor accounting on the Afghan side. So I'm not talking about military resources. I'm talking about the other instruments of national power, namely diplomacy. We don't make peace with our friends. We make peace with our enemies. And it's not generals that make that peace. It's diplomats. It's diplomats that sit down, build relationships, and over time get Pakistan to agree that if they halt bad behavior in this area, they can receive a reward or help in another area. It is diplomats that sit down with the Afghan government and say, if you don't change the political dysfunction in Kabul, we aren't going to release funds to you next quarter for ministry advising or for health and sanitation and education funding. This has to be done by our diplomats. And quite frankly, what we've seen out of the State Department in the first 6 months of this new administration is, I think it borders on strategic malpractice. We're hemorrhaging talent at the State Department. We don't have an ambassador in Kabul yet. We don't have an assistant secretary for South and Central Asia. And the Secretary of State has abandoned a 60-year-old bipartisan consensus on the importance of using human rights and democracy promotion as levers to work with our friends and to isolate those that we think are outside of the global rules-based liberal order. So I don't know how, even if President Trump fully resourced the war effort and then said, all right, now, diplomats, since we've pressured the Taliban so much, now you negotiate a peace, I don't know how they could do it. I mean, 80% of life is just showing up, and the State Department has not shown up.
Okay, so let's assume that they show up at some point. Look over the horizon for me, because to me, I think a lot of veterans heard that speech, and they nodded their head and said, okay, finally, somebody's talking about the other instruments of national power other than our military. So maybe we have the makings of a regional strategy that then sets the condition that the limited contribution that the military makes can be leveraged into some kind of peaceful settlement. When you look over the horizon, are there still too many variables to look and say, you know, I believe this has a chance, or I believe this doesn't have a chance? Simply too early, too many variables, to include your comments about the State Department.
Yes, certainly too many variables at this point to make any reasonable prediction. And to just return to the earlier point, a lot of it matters, or a lot of it depends on exactly how we use the military instrument of power in the Trump administration. So he said he's going to change troop levels. If that's 5,000 troops, that's very different if it's 50,000 troops. But I will say that overall, I'm skeptical that anything we do will produce an enduring, stable Afghanistan along the lines that both Presidents Bush and Obama envisioned. We couldn't do it with 100,000 troops. The Taliban has everything it needs to fight indefinitely. They have no reason to give up. They have no interest in giving up. They are a local, autochthonous insurgency that can draw on the support in the very villages they're operating in, and there's nothing we can do to change that. So we should perhaps separate out Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other transnational terrorist organizations that want to attack the United States from the discussion of the Taliban. We will not stop this Taliban insurgency with 5,000 more or 50,000 more troops. We might have more success against the transnational terrorist groups, which are the president's focus, but actions in that arena may destabilize Afghanistan further.
Okay, I want I've got an email I want to read to you. Hey, Mac, the other day you were talking about some comments that Tim Lynch had made on the program talking about the legitimacy of the Taliban in the eyes of many citizens outside of Kabul. His comments essentially were that the Taliban were more honest that the majority of disputes between people in an agrarian society are land disputes, and the Taliban settled those fairly in the eyes of many people and were not corrupt. Regardless of their religious affiliation, it seems like there would be a natural affinity between people that lived in rural areas for quote-unquote better government, which the Taliban seemed to provide. I'd be curious to hear Dr. O'Connell's comments on that. Legitimacy of the Taliban, and you're talking about it there.
It's complicated. Right. Yeah, it's a complicated picture. In poll after poll, it's pretty clear that the Afghan people do not want the Taliban to return to power. So are they popular? No. But are they considered legitimate in certain areas? Absolutely. I mean, one way to think about it, it's a silly example, but perhaps your readers will find it instructive. We've all seen the movie Red Dawn. Can anybody imagine a situation, no matter what services the Russians brought to the hill towns of Montana, that people would think they were a legitimate government? No, they're foreigners and they're invaders. So we focus often on what services can we help the Afghan government provide to the people of Afghanistan, and really all they hear in that message is, you're foreigners, and that means the government in Kabul is a proxy government of foreigners. So they do, the Taliban has more legitimacy than the government in Kabul in many parts of Afghanistan, east and south, because they are local. They are Pashtun. They are from the area, and they are not connected to a Western-backed government that makes it very easy to make arguments about colonialism and imperialism and Christian invaders.
How significant in terms of presenting this to an American population that has great difficulty wrapping its head around what it sees on TV, what it hears? In essence, we're trying to create an Afghanistan that has never existed in history in terms of a federal government and a national identity as opposed to a regional and local local identity, yes?
That's fair. Now, President Trump says he's moving away from that. I think when he says no nation building, what he means is we're not going to try to undertake efforts to change Afghan culture. That's why, because Afghan culture is a mountain that we can't move or climb around. That was a major conclusion of our book, is that in every area we looked at, development, police training, special operations, you name it, that there were huge cultural obstacles that prevented us from getting to our end state, even when we threw billions of dollars at it. So, bravo, Mr. President. Yes, you can't change Afghan culture. But here's the problem. If you don't advise and assist the ministries, the rule of law, the institutions of Afghanistan, then the government itself that we are supporting will continue to be corrupt, will continue to make land grabs, will continue to isolate the very population that will either support the government or the Taliban. And if they support the Taliban, the insurgency grows stronger. So this is a contradiction in the president's current approach that I have not yet seen reconciled. How will he diminish the credibility of the Taliban? How will he diminish their numbers and their capabilities if he is going to allow the Afghan government to remain corrupt and ineffectual? Because that's exactly what strengthens them.
Okay, another email for you. And I've got one more after that, and then I'll let you go. Are you pushed for time today? Or
I am. I think about 10 o'clock. We've got a few more. Go ahead.
Okay. Mac, could Aaron talk about big T, little T, and is essentially the president talking about drawing a line between big T, little T, big T coming from outside the country, little T being indigenous and local, his comments about that?
I think big T and little T mean the Taliban, I assume?
Correct.
Yeah, it is true that the Taliban receives significant support from outside of the country, but let's be clear, the Taliban think of themselves first as Pashtun, and the Pashtun region straddles the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. There are 40 million Pashtuns in the world. It's one of the largest ethnicities without a nation or without a state in the world. So that line between Afghanistan and Pakistan does not separate out into big T and little T, as your questioner is suggesting. It settles out into Pashtun. And some of those Pashtun networks have direct lines to Islamabad, which is why the president was sending a strong message to them.
Final question in 60 seconds. Should we be bleaching our history?
I'm sorry?
Should we be bleaching our Confederate history? How do we treat our... How do we treat... If you can do that in 60 seconds, how do you... how do we deal with the American history relative to slavery and relative to Reconstruction? And how do we deal with that?
It is a long and difficult problem. The entire story of the United States of America is a story of race, and those who think that's not the case don't know their history. But since this is a Marine radio station, let me close with a statement about how the president used Charlottesville in the address on Afghanistan, which I frankly found offensive.
Right.
So the beginning of the speech made some very strong statements saying that we, the country, must be united and that we owe it to the troops to not be divided at home. That's true to a degree.
Right.
But what is also true is that the president was using the blood of soldiers and the blood of our men and women in uniforms to say, because of them, you cannot protest, or because of them, you cannot criticize for issues about domestic policy. And that is false. That is not how the military works. We are not a political instrument, and we shouldn't be used to cover up other political problems unrelated to the national defense.
Well said. Well said. I need to have you back on, and I'd love to talk to you about, again, teachable moments in time. And I don't think the majority of Americans understand, and I would include myself in this. I didn't understand a lot about slavery other than its involvement relative to the Civil War. I didn't understand the history. First nation, that major nation that banned slavery is Great Britain. And I don't mean the importing of slaves, but banned slavery outright is Great Britain in 1833. So it tends to change your view of Washington and Jefferson freeing their slaves upon their death prior to that, because the greatest powers in the world all allowed slavery. It was accepted practice. But we don't know things like that. And our arguments
in... That's certainly true.
Our arguments
in... United States was late.
Right.
Like, the United States lagged behind the rest of every major power in banning slavery. And then after the Civil War, the sharecropper system in the South
right.
was effectively indentured servitude.
Right.
And then even after that ended, until the 1960s, there was de facto repression of blacks in the right. South to such a degree that they couldn't go to school or vote. So anybody who thinks the slavery thing ended in 1865 is just lacking nuance.
Right.
And it's important to pay attention that our country and our military is a multi-ethnic, multicultural military. It's one of our greatest strengths. And to suggest that people should just get over what was fought over at the Constitutional Convention, what was fought over in two or three attempts to compromise, what led to a civil war, and what led to federal troops in Alabama in my father's lifetime
right.
is not over. It's something that is part of our national character. We need to reconcile it, and we should all strive to do so seriously.
All right. I will let you go, Aaron. First of all, always love having you on. I'll shoot you an email. I would love to have you come on and talk about that issue, because I think it's a moment that the nation can learn, but it's a complex issue, as you and I both know, and it's overtly complex. It's not subtly complex. It's majorly
That's right.
complex. But I've enjoyed my own learning about it relative to thinking, you know what, I don't know as much about slavery as I should probably know, so let me investigate it. Anyway, all the best of luck to you. And always enjoy what you write and having you on. Thanks for the visit.
Thanks, Mac. I appreciate it.
All right, bud. See ya. That is the one and only Aaron O'Connell, doctor, Marine colonel, historian at the University of Texas, formerly at the United States Naval Academy. So interesting stuff. We're going to have Tim Lynch on to talk about Big T, Little T tomorrow. And it really, what direction are we pointed in now? And if we don't continue to develop two major lines, and that is the diplomatic, in my opinion, the economic piece of this, and do our best to drive a wedge between the external Taliban and local Taliban, really, the little T, as Tim Lynch would call it, has a quarrel with the federal government, who they perceive as corrupt. And their legitimacy comes from the fact that they settle things fairly. And the history of the region is when the federal government gets involved, that it's going to be corrupt and it's not going to be fair. So, you know, I really enjoy I really enjoy doing this show. I love these conversations. It's about the fourth one of those I've had this morning. I woke up at 4 o'clock for some reason and started calling my buddies, some across the planet. And by hook or crook, they picked up the phone. Anyway, my thanks this morning to Dr. Aaron O'Connell, Colonel, United States Marine Corps. He's also an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. That's big time stuff. He's also a writer, editor of Our Longest War, Losing Hearts and Minds in Afghanistan. He also wrote another book, actually, that talks about the insurrection. Hold on, I'll get the name of it. Aaron O'Connell. Making of the Modern Marine Corps. That's the name of the book. I knew it had a different title. It's called Underdogs, Making of the Modern Marine Corps. And what he chronicles is a very interesting part of Marine Corps history, which is post-World War II, when in the consolidation of the Marine Corps, the discussion was being had about doing away with the Marine Corps. And the different organizations that were put together and the campaign that was conducted so that the Marine Corps is in fact a law, right? The Marine Corps has to be a certain size by law. Imagine that. That was all done by active duty Marine officers who were told not to go up on Capitol Hill, and who did it anyway. So I think it's one of the most fascinating reads. It's called Underdogs, The Making of the Modern Marine Corps. One of the most fascinating reads that you can find. And his name is Aaron B. O'Connell, O'Connell. And as you can hear, smart guy. Obviously, very, very credible. Very, very credible, professionally. When you have on your resume, United States Naval Academy, you have University of Texas at Austin. That's some big time stuff. So I want to thank you for coming on this morning. We'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio on a Wednesday, hump day, coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.